How do you scream?
Yeah, I feel like my screaming comes in disobeying form, in adding visuals, in taking away text, not letting the reader feel like they know me or that they can master my work.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Alain Pelaez-Lopez about their manuscript Intergalactic Travels, Poems from a Fugitive Alien. Alain crossed the Mexican-American border as an undocumented immigrant at 5 years old. This interview was made possible with support from the Submittable Eliza So Fellowship. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this. On your website, it states, Alain Pelaez-Lopez is an Afro-Indigenous poet, collage, installation, and adornment artist from Oaxaca, Mexico. In their art, they explore the intersections of PTSD, undocumented immigration, indigeneity, queer feelings, and black flesh. And I was so intrigued by the language that you use. I was hoping you could specifically address PTSD, queer feelings, and black flesh.
Right. So the PTSD, I guess, in my work comes in through a lot of the memories that I have of my crossing, but also the fact that I don't necessarily remember my exact moment of the crossing. I remember everything before and everything after, but I don't remember those few days. And I think that a lot of my work tries to speculate on what happened. And that's why a lot of the forms are pretty innovative, with like the footnotes and the constant going back and forth throughout my childhood of trying to recall. So that's how I kind of address PTSD. And queer feelings has been interesting for me because my manuscript doesn't really talk about queerness, maybe once or twice. But as a queer person, I feel that I've never had a closet to come out of, particularly because I am marked as Black, because of my accent, the idea of closets never existed. So I feel that everything I write is by default always already queer, because there is that idea of something else. And then Black flesh has been quite interesting because I am Afro-descendant and I'm very much obviously Black, but I'm very light-skinned. And I think that when I write about Black flesh, I talk about like the experience of Blackness, particularly because I found out I was Black in the U.S. Because back home in Mexico, although I come from a Black village, our understanding of race is very differently because I come from an indigenous landscape as well. So indigeneity takes precedent over race.
You began making jewelry for an income as a minor, undocumented migrant to the U.S. As your work evolved, what can you say about the power of adornment, both in your art and on the body?
Oh, I love this question. I think that somebody who lived as undocumented, that meant to always be hiding from the police, from government officials. And I think that adornment is a way in which we reclaim our power. By adorning our bodies, we're saying, I am not going to be defined by a piece of paper. I'm actually a person. I am existing in this world. And I think it really fragments everything that we know about the undocumented migrant. And it also fragments how we understand talking back to politics, right? Because to adorn ourselves is to undo the language of illegal alien.
You begin your work, Intergalactic Travels, Poems from a Fugitive Alien, with a map drawn by you of New Spain, or Mexico as we know it today, noting that it had more enslaved Africans than any other colony in the Western Hemisphere in the 16th century, and that comes from Colin Palmer. I was hoping you'd begin by just reading the first few pages.
And to think that once, I thought we were lucky to trace the maps of our names to sailors and warriors. Where you found honor, we found our owners. Where you found one-third Italian, two-thirds Spanish, we found one-third Indian slave, two-thirds African slave. Where you found Mexicanidad, we found genocide. And to think that once I thought we were lucky to trace the maps of our names to sailors and warriors. Where you found an archive of extraordinary stories, we found our ancestors kidnapped, transported, and enslaved. Where you found romantic cities, we found occupation, plantations, and water pollution. Where you found mestizaje, we found total elimination. Sometimes I dream of no transatlantic slave trade. I try to imagine no last names, no settlement. No Spanish, no Dutch, no English, no Portuguese, no Italian, no. But I do, and I become illegal.
This entry, and to think once I thought we were lucky. How did your activism evolve from your experience as a child, and what did you used to imagine as luck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that this piece came from something I wrote, I want to say, maybe in 2012 or 2013. So most of my family is illiterate. In my immediate family, I'm one of the only people that know how to read and write. And my last name actually comes from the only literate person who was nearby when I was born, which I believe was a 12-year-old. My last name is that person's last name because it was the only person that could register me. So this idea of we lost language and we lost what the West assumes literature is through slavery and settler colonialism. So I think that before I really understood where my last name came from, I was like, oh, you know, it's definitely Latin American. And then as I gained more consciousness, I was like, oh, no, well, that's from Spain, right? And when I started to research Spain and to really look at the slave trade in what is now considered Mexico, it's when I realize that the archive for me, although I can trace my Zapotec roots because my family is still alive and the culture is very much alive, I can't trace any of my Black roots. Yes, I have Black family members, but whenever I ask, it's like nobody knows anything. So that idea of before I thought I was lucky because I was like, oh, I can trace everything. And then as I grew older, I realized that, oh, well, there's definitely one of the lineages I cannot trace.
In this section of the book called Undocumented, you include pieces from the actual U.S. immigration application. And in one series, you print your name, and where you're asked, write your name in your native alphabet. You respond, you took my alphabet, my language, my people. What is it like for you to find generations of your story forced into these bureaucratic boxes?
I don't think that my story, I guess, is expected, right? When I'm engaging in these forums and I'm being asked about myself, the one thing that is the least expected is for me to still claim an indigenous identity, because the U.S. assumes that most Indians are vanished or are disappearing. So that insistence of me still being here is, I guess, why I felt that I wanted to write on the immigration forms.
And the poem that follows is Black Indian Crosses Border at 5 years old, in which you write it in Zapotec, Spanish, and then in English. But the verb to leave becomes a repetition in all three languages, I'm assuming. What does that word mean to you today, to leave?
When you leave something, you never know if you're returning, right? Because to leave is to have done. And when I migrated to the States, I came on my own. I was 5 years old. I knew I was leaving home, and the idea of when am I going to return didn't occur to me. And I think that as the years went by, I remember my first couple of years, I would call my grandmother and tell her how much I did not like it here, and I wanted her to convince my mom to have me go back home. And that happened for about 7 or 8 years. And after those 7 or 8 years, I actually stopped answering phone calls from my grandmother because the fear of never being able to go back was so intense that speaking to her was a reminder that my experience as undocumented felt more like a sequestration of not having the freedom to move means not having the freedom to live a livable life.
We were talking earlier about how you use new forms and you sort of break rules. In one of them, you use font size and visuals to make statements. There's a poem about an event in which 9 people died in a sweltering 18-wheeler trying to make it to the border. And you write, "People died," in a font that covers the entire page. But the next page, in very small letters at the bottom, you write, "I just want the world to love us and hold us." And I was wondering, what world are you imagining? You know, what does it look like or feel like?
Mm-hmm. I think that the world I'm imagining is a world where we no longer normalize migration, because I think that in our contemporary day, people are migrating because they are dying, because they don't have access to water, they don't have access to fruit, to vegetables, to work. And I think that the world I dream of is a world where forced migration is no longer a condition of possibility for people. But I think that in a different sense, I imagine a world where the us is other people who have been forced to migrate. Because I think that when you're forced to migrate, it's such a catastrophic violence that we lose a toolkit of care, and we don't know how to care and hold for one another. So when I say I want the world to love us and hold us, it's I also want us as people who've already left home to develop new ways of loving and caring that are first and foremost rooted in our spiritual and emotional health.
You include an email exchange with a professional person about the immigration status in court. And the refrains you pulled were 2 lines where they wrote, "You don't want to run out of time," and "I hope you're having a great day." And I wanted to know, what are you asking of the reader by including that communication?
Yeah, I think that part of the emails is to show people that, right, I am this person who has been undocumented most of my life. And in an email exchange with a lawyer, it's very obvious that I am trying to figure out if there is any way I can adjust status. And, you know, for the lawyer to just reply, "You don't want to run out of time," and the email with, "I hope you're having a great day," is this idea of, well, do cases like mine matter, right? And if this is an immigration lawyer who makes their living off of immigration cases, and my case doesn't matter, then what cases do matter, and how are our lives quantified, and who is deciding this qualification of life? And I think it's all rooted to how the law authors us, right? The law authors Black subjects as, well, back in the day, we were slaves, then we were 3/5 human. I mean, we were slaves and 3/5 human. Then we became fugitives if anybody ran away from the plantation. Then we were Negroes, right? So this idea of there's been so many authorings of Blackness, and indigeneity is authored as gone. Then this makes sense of you're running out of time, right? Because both of these other identities that I embody at the everyday have already run out of time.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Alain Pelaez-Lopez about their manuscript, Intergalactic Travels, Poems from a Fugitive Alien. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. was hoping you would read Vision on the 11th Day of July, 2014.
Yes, okay. Vision on the 11th Day of July, 2014. On tax-free day, we will head to the 99-cent store to stock up for the fall of this empire, a war that we win.
What is winning look like?
I think winning for me is not comparing ourselves to others and also refusing a one-dimensional story. Because when we win, the war means that we're able to write the stories as we want them to be read, understood, and experienced, because right now the law is authoring our stories. So this poem is also about poetry. The poetry world has been a gatekeeper for people who don't have MFAs, for people who write in bastard languages and any type of pidgin languages, and also for people who the poetry world says there's too much of you in it, right? You're not expanding for your audience to be widened. And I think that the war that we win is a war where we write for ourselves, and then whoever shows up, and there's no need to convince anybody.
I love that. And it takes me to another place on the immigration forum where you write, "Poems are evidence, sir. Read poems." Can you talk about that directive?
Oh, yes. So as a writer, I think about writing all the time. And whenever I think, if I go to a reading or if I tell my story somewhere, one of the things that I get is, "Oh, you're so brave," or anything like that, right? Which for me, I mean, maybe the first time I was like, "Oh, thank you." But after that, I was like, "Okay, well, that doesn't say anything." And I think that I get that statement a lot because people are shocked. But my story is not some very distinct narrative. There's so many poets out there who have very similar experiences as me. Many formerly undocumented poets who are Black, who've crossed the border, who have tried to talk back to immigration. And immigration is bad, we know that, right? But people are talking about it as if all of this is new, and it's not. There's actually an archive of how much damage the immigration system has done to migrants, but also how much the immigration system has damaged U.S. citizens, particularly American Indians and African Americans in the U.S., because American Indians are the last people in the U.S. who have received U.S. citizenship in 1924. That was less than 100 years ago. And in 1924 is also 2 weeks after American Indians received citizenship, like the language of the illegal alien 2 weeks later is developed. And before, indigenous people were considered aliens. And then they're granted citizenship, and then they create a new category of aliens. So I think that poetry as evidence should really be considered in the law, because poetry and culture is always speaking back to power.
In this section called Post Documents, you write, "A reclamation of my rights as an undocumented person, 2016, including, I have the right to be afraid. I have the right to put as many locks on the door as I want, and I have the right to have an accent." And in this section, "I have the right to a home," you write, "I have the right to a home free of settlement." What does that mean to you?
Mm-hmm. So I was actually born in Mexico City. My family is from the southern Pacific coast of Oaxaca, Mexico. And I grew up there. Like, Mexico City was just coincidental. Our home is really interesting because the village that I grew up in, that my mother was born in, actually, my grandmother migrated there from another village, which is a very rural village of Black folk who are like much darker skin than I am. And all of that area is Zapotec territory. Where we live right now is shared Zapotec territory and Mystic territory. But you can tell that that used to be a settlement. There are Catholic churches built by missionaries and padres that were built by the Zapotec and Mystic people. And there's also a huge shame around Blackness, which is also signaling settlement, right? And for me, a home free of settlement is a home where we're no longer ashamed of our Blackness. And it's also a home where we can step away from the nation of Mexico to really center Zapotec and Mixtec people. And, you know, if people wanted a sovereign nation, but it's only if people wanted, and just a commitment to life outside of Spain, Portugal, and in my case, the Netherlands. When I got status and went back home, I was taken to my grandfather's family home and found all these records, and all their names are in, their last names are in Dutch. So this very much presence of the slave trade was there, right? So I think a home free of settlement is also a home where we can get rid of our Dutch last names and our Spanish last names and reclaim Zapotec names.
At a reading in Missoula, Montana, you read an artist's manifesto for brown folks surviving the empire. And I know it's also in this manuscript. Can you just talk a little bit about how the manifesto came to be?
Yeah. So I've been asked to give a keynote/poetry reading at a queer and trans Latin American conference. And the night before the conference started, you know, Trump's election had just been announced. And one of the things that was really on my mind is, okay, as somebody who's going to open this conference, I have to name that somebody whose candidacy has been very anti-immigrant and also has operated under racist, homophobic, and transphobic commentary. Like, I have to say something. And that night, I stayed up in my hotel room the entire night. I was sitting in that desk from, I want to say, 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. And I just wanted to also figure out for myself, how am I going to recalibrate my worldview so that I can move in a way that makes sense for me with the recent political shift. And as an artist, I was like, okay, well, the one thing I know to be true is that the only way to change society and politics is by changing culture. And literature is a form of cultural production. So I just decided to write about the only thing I knew, which was art. And I think a lot of the artists that I talk about, I don't really name anybody, I talk about art forms. I was thinking about people in my mind who really inspired me and trying to describe why they've inspired me and why their commitment to art makes me believe in the arts. So I'll read, I guess, what is the introduction before I get into the breakdowns of the different art forms. An artist's manifesto for brown folks surviving the empire. I believe in the Ghanaian concept of Sankofa. We must always go back and get that which we have lost. What we have lost as African diasporic people, as indigenous people, as queer people, as trans people, and as undocumented people is memory. We have lost our memory. Slavery, indigenous genocide, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, anti-blackness, patriarchy, among hundreds of oppressive structures, all have one thing in common. They work to uphold capitalism and white supremacy by making marginalized people forget who they are. And just for one second, let me tell you who we are. We are resilient, messy, powerful, politically incorrect, vulnerable, lovable, and fierce as individuals. As marginalized people, we have been tasked with a responsibility to remember. Remember that this was never the way life was supposed to be. Remember that if we cannot locate home, we can always imagine and craft such a place. Remember that we are not alone and that our ancestors have left us blueprints of how to resist, survive, and thrive. And those blueprints lay in the power of art. In order to win the revolution, we are going to need artists.
So you begin with a list of types of artists, starting with dancers. And you reference dance throughout your collection. Why is dance necessary to live and to resist?
Yeah, okay. So I love dancing. One of the things that's interesting about where I come from is we have this one dance called El Baile del Diablo, which translates into the dance of the devil. And it's like a ceremonial dance where we literally dress with devil masks and dance in a circle. And then a lot of the elders, women, they are drumming around us. As I was doing a lot of research, you know, because I was just like, oh, you know, it's this like indigenous dance from the Zapotec community, or that also is shared sometimes with like the Mystic people. When I began to really look into it, I realized that, or I found out that it's actually a dance that comes from part of Angola. And for me, I think that dance has become a way in which I really meditate on Black experience. And also the popular dances in Latin America are things like bachata, cumbia, which both bachata and cumbia are also developed by folk who were enslaved. One of the stories is that those dances come from the steps, the way that they've been invented were so that people in chains could dance them. So I think that for me, I reference dance a lot because it also is a way in which to transgress violence, and it is joyful, right? And what larger protest than to experience joy when the law is very much trying to say that somebody like you is not worthy of joy. And also just dance is all about movement. And although a lot of what I've been talking about is about the tragedies or whatever being undocumented, there's also something very beautiful in the state naming me undocumented, but me being very much able to stand in my power and still move and continue living my life.
Alam Pelaez Lopez currently lives in California, where they are pursuing a PhD in ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. Their work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net. Look for more information about them and their work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.